Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
Hello and welcome to episode 4 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show interested in all things space. And unlike the previous 3 episodes you've heard this season, this one reverts to our standard format of myself being here in Salmon Arm and co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And Tim, please tell us of today's topic.
You bet, Steve. The introduction to our show now includes a snippet from Frank Sinatra, Fly Me to the Moon. And I wonder, back in the day, Frank might have ever imagined that here we are talking about mining on the moon. And that's today's topic. And there's just so much to cover off. I don't know how we'll do it, but you know what? We're always up for a challenge. And the really important place to start, I think, is the very fact that we're actually turning the corner on this, moving from the idea or concept of mining on the moon to actually sending spacecraft there to lay the foundations for mining that I think will actually start within the next decade.
Well, why bother with mining lunar resources when we have so many more on the Earth to exploit? And that's a term I don't use lightly.
You know, I think we need to go there today, Steve. It's one thing for us to have the scientific tools and perhaps the commercial need to mine lunar resources, but you're absolutely right. It's an undertaking that comes with considerable costs, ethical and legal questions. I mean, think about Sinatra's song again here. Obviously, the moon was being romanticized, but what we're about to do is turn the moon into the largest possible open pit mine.
Oh, wow, that's pretty harsh, Tim. The problem, I suppose, is that it's happening so fast, and if you will, in plain sight. And most people might simply say, well, there's nothing to see here, just a bunch of wild speculators rushing to an imagined gold rush, and it doesn't affect me, so who cares?
It's a fair point, but in our time today, we want to cover off just how quickly the mining prospects are changing, what resources up there might be available, and the challenges that exist, and just who's rushing into those fields of gold on the moon. But on the science end of things, a great deal has changed and is changing rapidly, the prime example being 3D printing. Now, the use of that breakthrough technology in space is real. Take a matter of any sort, like the dirt on the lunar surface, and use software and hardware to build just about anything you can imagine, just from one layer of molten plastic on top of another. That's going to enable 3D printers operating in space or on the moon to build structures, the tools that might be needed, and everything else to operate a mine on the moon. And our terrestrial observations of the moon's composition are now being complemented with ever more sophisticated satellites that are orbiting the moon, and starting this year, research that's being conducted on the lunar surface itself.
Well, putting it that way, I can imagine how the aspect of 3D printing could be a game changer, if you will, a paradigm shift. So even as the costs go down of reaching low Earth orbit, or for that matter, reaching the moon itself, if you can construct mines, spacecraft, and source energy on the moon with 3D printing technology, that negates the necessity of hauling structures from the Earth all the way to the moon. Well, that's not the way they did copper mining in Sudbury way back in the 20th century. But before we start looking for those minerals and what have you, let's take a quick look, shall we, at what was presumed to be on the moon before any exploration actually occurred.
Yeah, so we're talking about the speculation from the naked eye observation and that of using Earth-based optical instruments such as telescopes and spectrometers. And with regard to the latter, people, listeners to our show, may recall from an earlier episode that a new element, which was later named helium, was actually first discovered in the sun's atmosphere in 1868 and wasn't discovered here on Earth in our atmosphere until 1895.
Yeah, that was amazing. Well, right you are about that. So let's examine some of the expectations made by scientists just based from our earthly observations.
And we're not talking about the moon being made of cheese, I'm sure.
No, Tim, we're going to pass on that one. Scientists believe that moon dust would be primarily composed of rocks and minerals similar to those found on Earth, and expected to find materials like silicates, basalts, and other common minerals.
You know, but that hardly sounds exciting or worthy of the effort.
Well, you're totally right on that one. And they expected the lunar surface would have a layer of extremely fine-grained dust, or regolith, if you will, thought to be the result of billions of years of micrometeorite impacts breaking down larger lunar rocks into smaller ones. And further, that layer of dust might be meters deep, able to swallow meandering astronauts and machinery itself.
So we did know that the moon didn't have an atmosphere or very little, so it was expected that the surface dust would not be weathered or eroded by the wind and the water as it is here on Earth.
That's right. And scientists anticipated that moon dust would be exposed to high levels of solar and cosmic radiation on its surface, rendering it radioactive. Now, we've mentioned before that the term radiation is a trigger word, and it must be remembered that all life on Earth has evolved to live in and on our naturally occurring radioactive planet. But we'll talk about more of that in a future episode. But Tim, all this learned speculation doesn't sound like there's any real viable reason for going to the moon searching for resources.
Well, in the intervening years, though, both human and robotic exploration have shown there's a number of very interesting mining opportunities, and let's just take a peek at those. So the first on my list was helium-3. And so while it's not a mineral in the traditional sense, helium-3 is a valuable isotope of helium, and it's extremely rare here on Earth, but it's also thought to be more abundant on the moon's surface, particularly in that lunar regolith or soil. Helium-3 has the potential applications for nuclear fusion, incredibly important if you think about converting it into clean and virtually limitless energy.
Now that you mentioned helium again, I did a little bit of research and found that the lunar surface is now believed to shelter an astonishing 1.1 million metric tons of helium-3, of which just 25 tons could meet the entire annual energy demand of the United States. And I found out that helium-3 fusion produces non-radioactive charged particles, and moreover, it's a renewable resource perpetually replenished by solar winds on the moon's surface. And that was a surprise to me.
And me too. But there's others. There's more. There's water ice. And we have to start with an important reference to it because it's not a mineral, but water ice is a crucial resource, as you would expect on the moon. And it has been detected in the permanently shadowed regions near the lunar poles. Water, of course, could be used for life support, but also as a source of oxygen and hydrogen for breathable air and rocket fuel and for creating habitats and propellant.
Okay, Tim, but in my books, that's simply a fuel to provide further space travel or returning to Earth. There's got to be more to it than that.
Yeah, why go all that way if that's the only reason? And so there are some other minerals and resources of potential value that we've tracked down or have been identified. Some of them I'd never heard of before, Steve, so I won't make it sound as if I'm an expert. One of them is called, I believe, limonite. And it's an iron titanium oxide mineral that is relatively common on the moon. It contains both iron and titanium, which are, of course, valuable elements for industrial applications, including the potential construction of spacecraft or other Earth-based industries.
Well, Tim, I too have never heard of the ilmenite, but my ears did perk up with the mention of titanium.
But there is another one, Steve. It's called anorthosite, and it's a type of rock that is rich in plagioclase feldspar. It could be useful in the construction material for lunar habitats or the infrastructure due to its relatively high strength and thermal stability. Here's another one, regolith-derived minerals. So you've got that soil, an abundant amount, of course, and it contains all kinds of other minerals, including silicates, oxides, and metals. And some of those could also be processed and utilized for various purposes, including building materials, manufacturing equipment, or even producing oxygen. Here's another one that most people may have heard something about, which is rare earth elements. While the moon doesn't have a whole lot of that, it does have some, and they are essential for modern technologies. And their extraction from the moon could potentially reduce the dependence on hard-to-come-by sources here on Earth. And finally, I've got one more, Steve. Iron. It's common on the moon, and it could also be used for manufacturing, once again, helping to build structures and equipment.
I was interested when you mentioned rare earth elements, and I had done a little research about that for earth-based purposes, and I found out that the adjective rare is a bit of a misnomer in the sense that those elements are not rare on the earth, but they are rare in heavy concentrations. So we know that China has a lot of concentrated rare earth elements. So there we go. Okay, you've given us a nice list of things that are valuable. So I can see that there is potential for mineral exploitation by nations and free enterprise companies. And this brings to mind a parallel of how Europeans sought and returned with riches from outside their realm way back in the 15 and 1600s.
Yeah, I think this is a good way to understand what's happening in terms of mining on the moon. We've also seen this play out around the world over time with the new lands offering new resources. And so you're talking about characters such as Marco Polo or Vasco da Gama.
Absolutely. And they too were faced with challenges in acquiring them. For instance, the European merchants traveled via land and water, both of which required specific new technologies, first for getting there and then transporting those resources back.
So we're talking about the requisite infrastructure that you'd need to put in place for those voyages, different kinds of ships that could handle the challenges, the skill sets needed for those sorts of voyages, the financial backing, which came typically from monarchs or even wealthy individuals.
Well, that's right. And the European quest for more resources via land in Asia, they went there for silk, their technologies, foods, porcelain, precious metals, gem, exotic animals. They went into Africa for gold, ivory, spices, timber, textiles, salt, more exotic animals, and I think the New World. What did you find there, Tim?
You're right, Steve. And then new things that were of interest, like precious metals such as gold and silver, tobacco, timber, furs, dyes, medicinal plants, and of course, exotic animals.
And prior to those riches pouring in, the initial ventures required financial backing, as you mentioned, either by kings and emperors or wealthy individuals. I found out that, for example, Marco Polo was financed not only by his father and uncle, but also by the Mongol Emperor Kublai Khan. And so he was financed by two different sources coming and going. That won't happen with moon voyages.
I don't know. We'll see. We haven't played that out just yet, but other explorers such as Vasco da Gama were financed by the crown, specifically King Manuel I.
And so we're about to travel not by land or sea, but into space, and that requires a whole new set of technologies and financial backing. Historically, we know that the first venture into space were the German V-2 missiles in World War II, and they reached altitudes of 176 kilometers, and that's above the accepted 100-kilometer boundary of atmosphere and space.
And then there's NASA's quest for the moon, which was financed by the American government. It was part of that ideological race between the forces of good, that would be us in the West, and the forces of evil, those atheist communists from Russia. And of course, then it was called the Soviet Union. And now the quest for further lunar exploration, today's story, is being financed by countries such as India, China, Japan, South Korea, the United Arab Emirates, the European Space Agency, and in addition to that, efforts by NASA and Roscosmos, which is the new funding source from the old Soviet Union and Russia.
And we mustn't forget private ventures such as Japan's iSpace and JAXA and Astrobotic, which is a Pittsburgh company planning to send missions to the lunar surface, delivering cargo not just for government customers, but also for other companies. Blue Origin, which we've heard a lot about, founded by Jeff Bezos, and it's working on its own lunar lander, and Moon Express, a Florida-based company working on another lunar lander. Tim, you've been sending me some news clips about spacecraft going to the moon with mining research in mind, and, well, I've been sending you the same kind of news clips. It's really hard to keep up with developments these days.
It's a bit crazy, isn't it? I mean, here's an example of one of those under-the-radar news stories that we've been sharing. This came earlier in the summer from the Australian Space Agency. They were participating at a mining conference in Australia where they detailed some of the work that they're being carrying out right now for a semi-autonomous lunar rover that's going to take lunar soil, collect it, extract oxides from the regolith, the lunar soil. And they expect to have that happen in collaboration with NASA on a mission in 2026. And so what, you ask? Well, the thing is, it's a precursor to their additional plans for a pilot processing plant, which will go into operation on the lunar surface in 2032. And according to their news release, the joint project is intended to, and I quote, quote, advance commercial opportunities in space. Steve, it's not going to be all fun and games before they start cutting ribbons on processing plants. What do we know about the hurdles that are, in fact, still ahead?
Well, assuming money is really not a problem, and that's a big assumption, there are always the technical issues. For example, the robotic Japanese M1 lunar spacecraft built by the private company called iSpace failed on April 25th of this year due to a miscalculation by the onboard altitude measurement system. The Russians' Roscosmos Luna 25 failed in its soft landing attempt on August 21st, and that was due to an engine failure during their critical moments before landing.
Okay, so win some, lose some, there are those failures, but there's also been things like the Chandrayaan 3 Indian spacecraft that made a soft landing on August 23rd, becoming the first country in the world to land a spacecraft near the moon's south pole. And that's uncharted territory, and it's where scientists believe they could find that frozen water we talked about earlier. And of course, it makes India the fourth country to achieve a moon landing.
And talk about rapid events. Just this morning, I read that the Indian Chandrayaan just completed a short moon hop by firing up its engines, rising up slightly over the regolith, and moving horizontally a few centimeters from where it originally landed. And that demonstrates the technological ability to move about from one potential mining site to another. Now, Tim, if we assume that financial and technical challenges are being met, and before we address the actual challenge of mining, we must consider the 1967 United Nations Outer Space Treaty. And we mentioned that in a previous episode. And in brief, the salient points to that treaty are: number one, no country can claim sovereignty over any part of outer space or its celestial bodies. And of course, that means the moon. Two, though it doesn't explicitly address resource exploitation, it does encourage international cooperation in space activities for the benefit of all nations. And thirdly, the treaty requires that resource exploration and utilization be conducted with regard for the corresponding interest of other countries, which will avoid harmful contamination of space and celestial bodies.
You know, that raises a host of ethical questions. And the intent of that treaty, the Outer Space Treaty, was to guarantee and preserve outer space and its potential riches for the benefit of mankind in general, and not just a few mining companies or entities. So putting aside those ethics for a second, and the realization that countries such as North Korea, well, there's Lebanon, Libya, Yemen, Sudan, Syria, there are a bunch of countries that never did sign that treaty. But let's examine the problems of dealing with moon dust and mining. These are the sort of real world problems of the moment. And the technological challenges are not insignificant. You've got that regolith, the lunar regolith. It turns out it's very abrasive, and it can be extremely difficult to work with. It can be quite dangerous for astronauts. There's the harsh lunar environment, of course, the extreme temperature variations, the lack of an atmosphere, of course, and it all requires very specialized equipment and techniques. And developing and deploying the necessary mining and processing technology is going to be another critical aspect before we can start making this a viable option.
And you mentioned that the lunar regolith or soil is quite abrasive, and it's also very fine, and it clings to spacesuits, equipment, and surfaces. and it can be harmful if inhaled, as Apollo astronauts and geologists Hirsch and Schmidt found out on the last mission to the moon on Apollo 17.
I remember the term they used. It was called, they called it lunar hay fever. So on that 3-day mission, Schmidt reported symptoms of an allergenic nature, including watery eyes and a runny nose. And it was caused by inadvertently inhaling some of that dust. Now, how did he do that? Well, they brought it back into their spacecraft at night or between spacewalks, and they tried to brush off the lunar soil, the regolith, but it turns out not easy to do.
Right, and you can't use something like an air hose and blow it off that way because air is so precious. Well, and in a somewhat similar vein, because there isn't any atmosphere, the hazards of solar and cosmic radiation can't be ignored. Now, the Apollo astronauts were exposed to higher levels of radiation than on Earth, but their exposure was within safe limits because of the limited duration of their missions. Long duration exposure will be another matter, and that has to be addressed if mining on the moon is to be a viable entity.
Well, there's no doubt it's going to be tricky because most of the work will have to be done by machines, but there'll also have to be those human operators. And the lunar regolith in the samples that were brought back to Earth, the good news was it was found to be consistent with levels of radiation that are naturally occurring here on Earth. So although they're going to need those habitats and shelters to protect themselves from the radiation, it seems that that might be viable, might be possible to do. Now, like on Earth, mining activities on the moon, they're going to have environmental consequences. So the dust generated during those mining operations could pose challenges for the equipment and potentially affect the lunar environment.
And of course, mining will destroy, if you will, the heretofore pristine state of the moon, described by the second man who landed on the moon, Buzz Aldrin, as being a magnificent desolation. And this will undoubtedly raise the ire of environmentalists, despite the fact that the moon has already been littered with space debris since the Soviet Luna 2 probe smashed into it on September 13th, 1959.
Wow, a long time ago. Now, here's another problem, and it seems crazy to be talking about it, but it's worth mentioning. It ties right in with some of the concerns we've had about the debris from the lunar surface. It's not too soon to be talking about debris above the lunar surface. So we've all become familiar with the term the junk in space junk, the remnants of spacecraft that are still orbiting the Earth and at risking the space station and any other human spaceflights. Well, it's really not going to be any different when the sky above the lunar surface is crowding up with mining shuttles. Eventually, accidents will happen, and the remnants of those accidents are going to be orbiting the lunar surface.
Well, in a previous episode, we did mention something of this sort, Tim. You might recall that the European Space Agency called for the creation of a time zone for the moon. They argued that with traffic increasing, confusion was going to become a real concern, and that traffic control of that space would be needed. I was almost going to say air traffic control, but I guess they're going to call it lunar traffic control or something like that.
Yeah, it's not air traffic, that's for sure. So, Steve, we've talked about the reasons for going to the moon and its challenges. What's the economic drivers? What's really pushing this?
Well, I'm concerned, shall we say, about what happens if they literally find a gold mine on the moon.
Well, first, let's ask the question of why gold is so much more costly than copper. They're both shiny, malleable, important, have low conduct electricity, and so on. Gold is much more valuable. The answer is rarity. Copper is 17 times more abundant than gold here on Earth.
Speaking of rarity, let's take a look at aluminum, Tim. And that's the third most abundant element in the Earth's crust, only behind oxygen and silicon. So it should be really cheap since it's so abundant. But though earlier humans went through the Bronze Age, the Iron Age, there was never an aluminum age way back in history. And the reason being for that, it's extremely difficult to extract. And so, for example, in 1852, the price of gold was $665 per ounce, but aluminum was $1,326. And to further the point, when the United States built the Washington Monument, the literal capstone was a pyramidal top made of 100 ounces of the most precious metal at the time, aluminum. Now, with improved technology, the price of aluminum has dropped from the 1852's $665 an ounce to 50 cents today. Similarly, copper is reduced in price to only $3.91 per ounce, but gold, it's $1,946 per ounce.
You know, this is basic economics. It's supply and demand. So, of course, we know the moon isn't made of anything like cheese at all, but we don't really know exactly what will be found in abundance until we get more seriously into this. But it obviously is possible that some of the things that can be found and mined on the lunar surface could change the value of the products down here on planet Earth.
Absolutely. And as we record this episode about mining on the moon, we're awaiting news on yet another country's bid to get started. Japan has a mission slated to deliver a lander to the lunar surface. And as we said at the top, perhaps the key takeaway when it comes to this topic is that we've turned a corner. The promise of returning humans to the lunar surface for the first time in 50 years is different now. We're not talking about a space race for ideological purposes. We're talking about mining for resources.
So, Steve, we've had a really good crack at this very interesting topic this afternoon. The reality is that there is plans underway, things happening in space every month, every week now, that are pointing us in one direction, and that is that mining on the lunar surface is coming to a satellite, an Earth satellite near us, the moon. It's happening, and I don't think it's going to get stopped. Steve, that's all the time we have for our show this afternoon. This is Tim Woods in Brentwood Bay.
And Steve Lowry here in Salmon Arm.
And we'll see you next time on Space Talks.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring brings.